Alex.
I'm Kayla.
I'm Sally, and today we're honored to have with us Zoe Levitt. Zoe is a senior retail and consumer product group analyst at the firm CB Insights, and she has experience as a journalist, a researcher, and an analyst both in the United States and China. And in 2017, she was named LinkedIn's top voice in retail. She has published almost over 20 articles on LinkedIn about her analysis, and she has like 58,000 LinkedIn followers, which to me is just wild. I didn't know that anyone actually followed people on LinkedIn. So we're really excited to have Zoe with us to talk about her career path, her technological communication skills, and her career as an analyst.
Great. And so Zoe, thank you for joining the podcast. We're just really excited. Maybe you can start off by telling us a little bit more. We sort of introduced you, but maybe you could tell us more about some of your big leaps in your career and what you're really excited about right now.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. And actually, thanks for bringing up the LinkedIn Award. That was pretty exciting. But in fact, most of the articles that I publish on LinkedIn, I originally wrote for CB Insights. So I work currently as a consumer goods and retail analyst for CB Insights, which is a sort of innovation analytics platform. So it's a terrific combination of writing and analysis, as well as emerging next generation technologies. The heart of CB Insights is a software platform that we sell to venture capital firms, banks, corporations looking to improve their innovation practices. The platform is based on web crawlers that automate the aggregation and cleaning of data. So every day the platform is going through millions and millions of sources, looking at news mentions, funding information, SEC filings, acquisitions, hiring data, et cetera, to really be able to track theoretically every startup in the world, as well as what some of the major corporations are up to in terms of their internal R&D and also investment and acquisition strategies. So it's pretty exciting to have access to all that data. We provide that platform to our clients, and then my role is as a research analyst is to use that same data to dive in really deeply to the consumer sector and really keep a pulse on emerging trends. So it's pretty exciting. I'm certainly happy to talk more about some of those trends later on. Prior to CB Insights, I worked as an equity research analyst at a bank in New York. And then prior to that, I actually lived in Shanghai for about 2 years working in the marketing department of a new division of the Bank of China, which was pretty intense to be a foreigner in a state-owned enterprise over there. Got to kind of see behind the curtain with a lot of Communist Party activities and things like that. And then prior to that, I was at Stanford University for undergrad studying international relations.
So a lot to dive into here. My first question, when you look behind the curtain of the Communist Party in China, what did you see?
Sure. So, you know, it was interesting. And of course, this was already a couple years ago. Things there changed so quickly. So I would not want to be presented as a, you know, entirely up-to-date expert on all this. But I was with a division of the Bank of China, which is not the Treasury. It's equivalent to the Bank of America. It's a private company, but is majority owned by the Chinese government. So it was interesting to see that a lot of, I guess, the influence of the government was much stronger than I expected, even in the day-to-day workings of the business. So, for example, when I first joined the company, it was a new division focused on consumer loans. So it wasn't, you know, too communist. These were small-scale loans for people to take out to do things like buy iPhones or, you know, travel abroad to Europe for vacation or things like that. But we were, that was in the marketing department, but this division, this company was the I believe the only or one of the only companies authorized to give out these small-scale consumer loans in the city of Shanghai. So we really didn't need to do a whole lot of marketing for those first few months. So that was one interesting aspect. Another interesting aspect was that a lot of the senior management in the company is all members of the Communist Party. So my colleagues who were local, Shanghainese residents would talk about that decision to whether or not to join the Communist Party, but in a way that was really divorced from the politics of it. They viewed it as more of an honor society, I'd say, kind of a way to get ahead in school initially and then in business, rather than kind of a full-hearted buying into the ideology of it. But then on the other hand, you know, some of the, again, today's senior management who came of age in the 70s, in the 60s, the ideology perhaps is much stronger. There were also some interesting company activities that would take precedence sometimes over the day-to-day operations of the business. For example, every year the company would stop work for 3 days and take the entire company on what they called a red trip to visit a area of Communist Party interest. So when I was there, I actually went on this trip. They took the whole company on about 100 people on an overnight train ride to go visit some old Communist Party military bases outside of Beijing. So that was pretty intense. Yeah, pretty interesting and kind of unexpected. You know, it's hard to imagine division of Google shutting down for the day to go to take the whole company to go visit some political activity.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, I guess that was like an aside because you were no longer at that firm. But I just pulled up your LinkedIn list of articles so our listeners can get sort of an idea about the kinds of things that you do when you say that you like look into this data set and pull out interesting stories. So just some of your recent headlines. This secretive German firm is consolidating the U.S. coffee industry. How blockchain could transform the way you buy groceries. Squeezed by private labels, big brand foods look to startups. So that's the kind of thing that your customers would have access to. Like that kind of the data that underlies those stories are the kind of things that your customers would have access to if they subscribe to your platform.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And also we do much kind of more in-depth consulting work for our clients on my team as well. So, you know, I've worked with a lot of the major CPG, global CPG companies to help them look at startups that might be threatening them as well as startups offering new business models. Like, you know, there's a lot of interest right now in blockchain, in drone delivery, perhaps looking farther out, in machine vision and IoT technologies to track consumers. So there's both startups competing through, by launching new brands and then startups using these new technologies to, maybe help some of these big companies adapt.
That's fascinating.
We're impressed.
Yeah.
For your next product for your company, we highly suggest making this for science. It will like comb all the literature and like ping you with a infographic of everything that you need to know from the last 24 hours.
Ooh.
And we would be happy to be beta testers.
Yeah. Okay, yes. I will suggest that. Absolutely.
It's probably not as much of a moneymaker. Like, we're no P&G.
Sorry,
yeah, grad students aren't known as having a lot of money to burn.
We don't have a lot of liquid assets.
Sadly.
Assets, but
right.
We digress.
So Zoe, how did you become interested in this line of work? And did you always know that you wanted to be the top voice of retail? Like, does this just come to you someday?
It's kind of funny when I think about it, but I have to say this really is the type of job that I imagined myself doing. I mean, it's pretty amazing. Especially since my previous job in New York was working in finance and I did not enjoy that one bit. So I've been so much happier here at CB Insights. But I think, you know, I've always been very interested in writing, very passionate about creative writing, journalism. My dad had been a journalist as well, so that really inspired me, or had worked in journalism, so that really inspired me when I was little. And then at Stanford, of course, being immersed in Silicon Valley, that Silicon Valley can be a little bit of a bubble, but it was also so exciting to feel like here you have a front row seat to all these new technologies that are coming out. You're kind of getting a sneak preview of some of these ideas that everyone will be talking about in 5 years or 10 years, these technologies that will be changing people's lives. So here in my current role, being able to still keep an eye on these technologies and to spot trends, but then also to write about them is, really, really exciting for me. Really terrific.
One of the questions we had actually was, how does your company make money? But it's clear that you sell the platform of this software. But from your point of view, like, what does your day look like? Do you have access to more data than your customers? Like, do you have, like, the next generation of conglomeration software? Or, like, do you wake up in the morning and, like, see what the software has spit out about the new trends and then write about it? Or can you speak a little bit about your day and what your job looks like as an analyst?
Absolutely. So the main way the company makes money is by selling the software platform, but increasingly we're also selling my work and the work of the analysts on my team. So we give a lot of that away for free, as you've seen, to kind of get people interested. I mean, we give away a huge amount for free, but then, you know, of course, saying, okay, here's how blockchain might affect overall food supply chains is not, you know, a major CPG company might see that and say, okay, well, how is it going to affect me? So then that's what they then pay for that and get access to me as the analyst or my colleagues that focus on other areas. You know, I have colleagues focused on healthcare, artificial intelligence, self-driving cars, all these different areas. So we're beginning to monetize that and increasingly so. From a day-to-day perspective, the platform spits out a huge amount of data. So it's up to us to, you know, keep an eye on that data and kind of over time, as you get to know the industry you cover, build narratives atop that data. So we do not have additional software tools that our clients don't have access to. We're using the exact same software. You know, the difference is just that I'm using the software every single day and, you know, looking at these deals and these patents and these acquisitions every single day. Whereas, you know, my client's first priority is not looking at CB Insights platform. Their first priority is their own job. So, you know, so I might have just more of a kind of bird's eye view of what's going on in the space. You know, I like to start usually by looking at the startups that have raised funding recently or have announced new product lines or new hiring initiatives recently. And then over time you kind of see, you know, okay, here this startup just raised funding, this startup just made a big announcement, they seem kind of similar, maybe there's a trend, maybe this is like a new business model that we're starting to see. And you kind of pick up those trends over time.
Well, I was going to ask you about the example that made you famous in the minds of people besides your friends. You found the Amazon drone patent and you were on Good Morning America?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to talk about that.
Okay, tell us more.
Sure. So this was pretty exciting. Last year, CB Insights had just brought in patent data to the platform. So this might be relevant to to PhD students. But we bring in the whole U.S. patent database and make it searchable, by keyword, by company, all that.
Gosh.
And I was working.
Can I have it? Yeah. Sorry. We're too poor.
Sure. So I was working on actually a client project looking into food delivery. You know, Amazon's doing everything right now and they file a huge amount of patents. So I was looking at, have they looked into drones for food delivery? They have. I then came across, just kind of while scrolling through these horribly boring, you know, black and white patents with so much text.
Those line drawings though.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden I open this file and there's a line drawing of like, yeah, the Death Star like floating above the sky. So this was a patent for a flying warehouse. So this would be, it looks kind of like a blimp. It's very, you know, it's a little creepy looking. But it's this huge flying blimp, and then the blimp would hold products, and then smaller drones would fly back and forth between the blimp and the ground to deliver the products from the blimp to customers. So it's pretty crazy. And you know, it is the use case would be that the blimps could fly. They talk about, for example, if there was a big football game going on, the blimp could stock up with hot dogs and jerseys and then float over the stadium, and then drones could fly down from the blimp to people sitting in the stadium to deliver them things much more quickly. So it's interesting. I thought it really blew my mind seeing this picture, but I just kind of tweeted it out. And then the CB Insights main account retweeted my tweet. And then it kind of went viral. I mean, not hugely viral, but went...
Niche viral.
That's yeah. I mean, and I also just joined Twitter at that point. I was really late to Twitter. So it really was shocking. And it started to get picked up. Then I think, you know, TechCrunch called and some other outlets called. And then the next day, I thought, you know, okay, maybe it's kind of died down. And this was also the week in between Christmas and New Year. So it was really quiet. I remember going into the office and I literally hadn't even washed my hair that morning because I was thinking it was going to be such a quiet day. And then all of a sudden we get a message from Good Morning America saying, we want to feature this on our show tomorrow morning. We want to talk to you right now. So it was very scary. I did not have time to kind of prepare aesthetically as I might have chosen to otherwise. We set up the call. We talked. They filmed me over Skype, actually, and then just put that clip on their show the next morning, which was really exciting.
That's amazing.
So when Good Morning America calls and you have no time for aesthetic preparation in the moment and really no time for, like, intellectual preparation.
Yeah.
What had you done in the previous week, month, year, lifetime to prepare yourself for that opportunity when it does happen? To be able to, like, go on national television and to be like, yes, these Amazon drones do represent a paradigm shift in the way that we think about consumer delivery, like super professional.
The way you just phrased it, I'm sure, was way better than I phrased it in the moment.
Yeah, I had 35 seconds to think about it.
Yeah, wow. No, that was great. You know, luckily I had taken a series of public speaking classes in the few months beforehand. So I had begun to do a bit of preparation in general about presentation when joining CB Insights. You know, it was a big kind of mental shift for me, realizing that it's not just your ideas that matter. It's the way that you present them as well. That can feel a little frustrating when you first realize that, I think, because I was certainly no good at public speaking out of college, and it certainly wasn't something that in college or in high school you have a lot of practice with. So realizing how to present your ideas clearly and confidently is very important. So part of it is just having faith in yourself as an analyst and your own ideas, and to remind yourself that you have so many thoughts about this area. I just discovered the patent and didn't have time to prepare too much for the specific TV clip, but I had been looking into, as you said, paradigm shifts in the delivery of goods and services for the past few months. So it's just a confidence builder to remind yourself that, you know, this is your job, and you may not think that the point you're about to make, you know, there's not a lot of time for nuance in TV, or in blog posts or in email newsletters or anything like that. So it feels intimidating to think, okay, well, I have, you know, 5x the amount of thoughts about this topic than I'll get to share. And, you know, here's one point, but there are all these different subpoints. And, oh, there's a lot of, you know, there might be some conflict here. And some people might disagree with this because of this. And, you know, I've thought a lot about this, but there's no time to get all that out. But most people are not going to be aware of all that going behind the scenes. It's on you to distill it into these very clear, very solid ideas.
That sounds a lot like our expectations, except that we don't get to do it on Good Morning America.
Right. It's like, you can present at this conference sub-session, which will have 15 audience members.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, one step at a time.
Well, on that note, so you said that you took some classes. What did you learn that changed how you were speaking?
Being able to speak off the cuff in a confident way. I remember the class I went to, and luckily CB Insights had an education stipend, so I could use that to take some of these classes, but there were a lot of activities where I would pull an object out of a hat and have to improvise just a quick 3-sentence speech about that object, or pull a photograph out of a file and have to improvise about that. So that kind of, you know, you look at the object, you breathe, you take a pause, and then you start talking. Even if that pause feels very long to you, it does not feel long to the audience. And then you talk in a confident way. You don't, you know, so much of presentation is body language, is your tone of voice. So you lean, you pay a lot of attention to that, as well as the ideas you kind of take as a baseline that you should have confidence in your ideas, that you need to believe in yourself as an expert in this given topic, and then focus on communicating these ideas that you've been working so hard on.
Fascinating. And it seems like with that sort of activity where you're pulling an object out and you have to talk about it on the whim, it seems like you're also sort of training yourself to be okay with making those fast decisions about
yes.
how you're going to do that.
That's a great way to put it. Absolutely. You have to be a little comfortable with ambiguity. You have to realize that every sentence you say is not going to be perfect. And again, you might not get the chance to share a lot of the nuance that you feel is very important. And that can be frustrating and is frustrating, but that's just kind of the way things work, especially since so much now is done over Twitter and over these short TV clips. So that's been a real learning experience for me too.
Well, on that note, so you have all this access to crazy amounts of data, and I'm sure spend a lot of time thinking about it, but you have those quick few seconds to talk to lay audiences on things like GMA. How do you take all of that, and how do you decide what needs to be shared?
It's a challenge. And I recently had my second TV appearance, actually my first live TV appearance, just a few weeks ago.
Oh, I saw it. It was amazing.
Oh, great. Thank you. On CNBC Asia. So that was pretty scary as well. And then I also just launched my own weekly newsletter that's going over consumer and retail insights every week. So in all these formats, you have to be much, much, much more concise than, you know, I think you'd hope as a PhD student that spent years researching your topic, or as an analyst that spent months, maybe not years, maybe for any particular topic, but months researching. So it's about thinking, okay, if I'm an investor and I am thinking about 10 things at once, and I'm going to read this email or watch this clip that will talk about 10 things, but I'm only going to remember one of them. What should that one thing be? As the speaker or as the email writer, you want to decide on that one thing in advance. And then, you know, and then of course they say, especially in live TV or in any sort of interview, if they ask you a question you're not quite as sure about, you can pivot back to your one main point. I can actually even bring it back to, I remember, when I was applying to college, writing my college application, and, my dad, who I think is a very good writer, telling me that these people are reading hundreds of college applications per day. You want them to be able to describe you in one word or in one phrase when they're kind of then pitching you to the, admissions committee to decide on you. So it's the same theory really in everything. You want people to be able to come away from your presentation with, you know, one sentence max practically about what they learned, which, yeah, can feel frustrating and then feels intimidating. But you want to have one point, one thesis, and then make sure that everything they might ask you about, every answer that you give can relate back to that point. So for example, for the Amazon drones, for the Amazon blimp, you know, the drawing of this blimp is wild. It looks super creepy. They kept trying to get me to compare it to the Jetsons, and I was kind of like, that's a little before my time. but kind of the main point I wanted to get across is that, you know, I can't tell the future. I don't know if Amazon's actually going to build this thing or not, but the main point is that they're looking for warehouse innovation. They're looking for ways to store the goods closer to the consumer. So that be that in a flying blimp, be that, you know, they've also filed patents for warehouses on trains and warehouses on trucks. You know, all this relates to the main point, and that is a point that will affect potentially how we all live in 5 years when Amazon maybe has little, you know, mini warehouses on every cul-de-sac with little drones flying back and forth between your house and that or something. So it kind of relates, you want to relate to this broader overall thesis.
Oh, that's awesome. So you just alluded to how the technologies can affect consumers' lives. And we'd love to dig into that a little more. Like, how do you see technology changing the way consumers live? And consumers here, I guess, like, means everyone. And do you think that all the changes are positive?
Sure. I mean, I would never say all the changes are positive. Absolutely not. I think it's interesting that some of these big companies like Amazon and Uber, they don't just affect their own verticals. They change all consumer expectations for speed and convenience across the board. People have certainly talked about this, but Uber doesn't just change how quickly I expect to get a car. It changes how quickly I expect to get my package delivered or how quickly I expect to get my takeout delivered. Because if I can get, you know, an Uber car pulling up in 2 minutes, why can't my pad thai at 2 a.m. also be showing up at my door in 2 minutes kind of thing? So it's this whole shift in the thought process for a lot of these really traditional food companies and clothing companies in the consumer space that have often focused pretty specifically on their own verticals, and, you know, looked at maybe innovations on the product side. So new lines of clothing, new ways to produce the products faster, new ingredients in the food that might make things healthier. But now, which I think is very exciting, so much of the innovation is taking place on the distribution side. And that's really focused on speed. And speed increasingly means predictive. So before maybe you even press that order button, Amazon already knows what you're most likely to click on, when you'll order it next kind of thing. You know, there are startups, and even, you know, Amazon, even Walmart looking at predictive fulfillment, so suggesting to you what you'll need before you even start to order it. So that's really interesting, but also, of course, much more invasive. Another kind of far emerging trend that that hasn't really caught on yet, but that will, is using Internet of Things technologies to just collect so much more data about consumers, even in their homes. So if you think about e-commerce, and, you know, even e-commerce is relatively new to some of these companies. I mean, you look at, you know, even big companies like Kellogg's don't even sell their own products on their own website today. But when you go to a website, the website can track where you came from, what you click on, how much time you spend on each page. But when you walk into a store, it's a black box. So there, you know, so now, in stores, there have been beacons around for a while that can track consumers' activity in the store. Increasingly, some innovative companies are looking to smart home technologies to track people's activity at home and then use that to suggest new products for you, to maybe see that, oh, you frequently buy these two things together. Let's start just bundling them for you to make them more convenient, to make that purchase more convenient. So this turns, it's not just a one-time purchase anymore when you purchase a box of cereal or a shirt. It's a relationship. When you make that purchase, you're entering a continuing relationship with the brand. That brand can use IoT to gather data about your usage of that product, your habits, and then again, going forward, use artificial intelligence to crunch all that data and come up with these huge insights to target you more specifically. So that's, you know, perhaps more convenient, but also more invasive.
And low-level creepy.
Exactly.
So maybe Amazon knows me better than I know me.
So Zoe, do you have an Amazon Echo?
Okay, so I recently just gave up and went all in on Amazon. I got Echo, I got Prime, I got the credit card, I just dove in. And it's a lot more convenient. But I, you know, they know everything about me now. So that's kind of the trade-off.
Interesting. Cool.
Yeah.
So I guess, are all changes positive? No.
Right. And then I get, the other thing I'd say is that, you know, of course, these technologies, right, can make things so much more convenient, and then we end up handing so many of the processes of our lives over to these technologies, but of course that leaves out a lot of people that, you know, can't afford to buy an Amazon Echo or things like that that these companies don't view as a viable consumer basis. So, you know, if we think going forward, you know, now Amazon owns Whole Foods. They're starting to make some products exclusive to Prime members. So I think they have a clothing line now that you can only buy that piece of clothing if you're a Prime member. So that's great for Amazon, but you could take this also to a very dark place. I'm not saying this will happen, but you could imagine, you know, a society in which there are people that lead, you know, Prime lifestyles, or whatever company is the biggest company back then, and then and get all these benefits and get all this free stuff because the companies want to access their data. But then people that are not viable customers get kind of shut out of all these advances.
Like if you could only get a fidget spinner on Amazon Prime.
God forbid.
Have like a class hierarchy in the classroom.
On a quick side note, how much of this data is mined by humans versus algorithms?
At CB Insights, we use, I'm certainly not an engineering expert, but most of it's automated. It does go through a human. We have a data team that gives it kind of a human eye to just give everything a sanity check. And then if for more complicated cases, the humans do come in. So it's this cool example of AI plus humans being more powerful than each one individually. You know, I think they've shown this in chess as well, that even, you know, AI beats humans very handily, but then human plus AI beats the AI. So this combination is more powerful than AI on its own.
So I think this is a question with a lot of artificial intelligence type technology, but when you think about, oh, like the analysis is mostly done by machines, but then of course humans are the ones who code these algorithms. At CB Insights, how do you think about eliminating certain human biases from your platform? Because like humans are flawed, so they're biased. So have you come across any of those issues where like issues of gender or racial or class or other kinds of biases like you see seeping into your platform, and how do you deal with that?
That's a good question. I know that's definitely an issue that I've read a lot about. I'm not quite sure if it applies to CB Insights in exactly that way, since we're kind of scraping the news that happens and the news that gets reported on. So I'm sure are biases on what type of companies get reported on. There's a bias across all of society on what gets considered technology and what does not get considered technology. You know, I've done some work looking at startups that are helping, making sort of next generation breast pumps for nursing mothers, for example. And some of these founders have talked very openly about how difficult it was to get VC funding.
Because there's no female VCs. I mean, there are, yeah, but like there's not.
Right. There's so few, and people talk about, you know, they come into the room and the VCs, they kind of giggle maybe, or they say like, oh, I don't, you know, really see the need for this kind of thing. So there's a lot of examples of that.
And we see that like in science as well, where we're both biomaterials students and we talk about a lot of like biomaterials products, but there's only been one class across all the biomaterials and drug delivery classes I've taken in undergrad and graduate school. There's only been one class where they talk about the IUD, which I would say is one of the most successful drug delivery devices ever. And it's like, no one in this classroom is going to have like an implantable hydrogel to treat their glioblastoma, at least until Kayla's research works. Right. But like statistically, like, 12% of women in this classroom have an IUD right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
So bias is everywhere.
That's such a good point. I mean, even things like, you know, I'm sure you've heard of like Soylent, like, the, you know, the drink.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And it's like.
People think Soylent is the next big thing, but it's just like it's like Slim Fast.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say. Right. It's like, okay, you know, there are a lot of these things that. When women do it, it's like, oh, that's cute. And then, you know, maybe men do it and it's like, oh, this is
a paradigm shift of the way our society functions.
Exactly. So, you know, I think hopefully that's changing. Especially with a lot of the news that has come out about sexual harassment, this year, I think hopefully, VCs are starting to, maybe open their minds a little bit. There's been, I've seen some kind of comments. I don't know how high up these people are, but saying, you know, oh, I'm hearing now that investors are so nervous about being accused of sexual harassment that they're not going to even take meetings with women. And so that's like, this is like worse for women now. And it's
good Lord.
Like, yeah. And it's,
don't Mike Pence yourself, men. Just be appropriate.
Right. That's the thing. It's like, if you're an investor, this is your job. Like your job, which theoretically you should be good at if you've risen to this level of being a VC or being an investor where you're making high profile investments. Your job is to make difficult decisions, to be a professional, not act like you're in kindergarten, but then to like make difficult decisions about things that are maybe outside of your immediate comfort zone. And that's how you can be a good investor, and that is, you know, the entirety of your job, a big portion of your job. So, you know, a lot of these things get, branching outside a little bit of tech, but a lot of these things get segmented as women's issues, which is gross, I think. Like maternity leave, and paternity leave, it should not be a women's issue, I think, you know? I mean, or anything related to birth control, certainly. I hate when you see birth control described as a women's issue in the news. This affects literally everyone. So it's frustrating, yeah, how these things get segmented.
Oh, absolutely. So, Zoe, I know on your CNBC Asia interview, you were talking about the nature of retail in 2018. Can you give us some, like, insights or hot takes on the future of retail in the next 12 months, in the next 12 years? Like, you've mentioned some of the trends that you're seeing, but, you know, anything our listeners should be looking out for, and they can be like, ooh, I heard about that first on Double Fist.
Yes. First of all, Amazon just opened on Monday, the last week of January, not sure when this podcast will go out, its automated store called Amazon Go in Seattle. this is not immediately transformative. I mean, Amazon, they'd initially been going to open it last year. It got delayed. I saw there was big lines outside the store when it first opened. But the idea is that there's no cashiers. I think you scan your phone or it somehow associates you with your Amazon account when you walk into the store and then tracks you using cameras and machine vision as you walk throughout the store and sees what you pick up off the shelves and then charges you automatically when you walk out. So you just pick things up and then walk out and get charged automatically. So this, you know, I think is it doesn't seem like it's ready for real mainstream rollout, but we're going to see more companies experimenting with this, and we're already seeing some of this in China, where mobile payments are much more accepted, and we're seeing some startups, like there's a startup called Standard Cognition that's working on it as well. And of course, anything that Amazon does gets so much attention. So I think we'll see more efforts in automating the store going forward. We could even imagine, perhaps not this year, but farther out, Amazon licensing this technology to other existing retailers. So Amazon not just opening up more of its own automated stores, but working with other brands to operate, you could imagine, like Macy's as operated by Amazon kind of thing.
And then they get all the data about what people are buying at Macy's.
Exactly. So that's, you know, not great for the retailers because Amazon's then intercepting all that data. So that's, you know, automation is one trend. Walmart's also doing a lot looking at automation. They recently expanded their pilot program for robots in stores. They now have robots rolling around the aisles in over 50 stores that are scanning the shelves. So they're not interacting with consumers, but they're making sure everything's in order. They're doing some restocking. I think we'll see more of that. Amazon, based on their patents, is also, I think, looking to automate the checkout process so you don't have to wait in line at the stores anymore. So this automation, first of these kind of backroom tasks and then moving forward into the store, into their customer-facing part of the store, we'll see absolutely. We'll see more bankruptcies in retail for sure. A lot of retailers went bankrupt last year. We're definitely going to see more of that and store closures as well. I think my thesis is that there's going to be less and less room for stores that are selling department stores or like multi-brand stores because they have less to differentiate them, you know, from other multi-brand stores. So we're going to see less of that. I think we'll also more verticalization. We're seeing a lot of e-commerce startups open their first stores. You know, this started with Warby Parker and Bonobos starting online and then opening stores. But now, you know, Casper has a store. Allbirds has a store. If you ever visit New York, you just walk around Soho and every single store practically is a startup.
Do these kind of like stores, which I would characterize as like the next generation, one generation up from a pop-up, like, do you think they make money? Or do they just exist so that you can, like, see the Casper mattress that you've heard about on every podcast, but not ours because we don't have sponsors? Or, like, see the Warby Parker glasses more than five at a time?
Yeah, the Warby Parker stores, I know for sure, make money. I think they've been public about that. The other stores, I would imagine they make, I'm not too clear on that, but it is a big marketing play for sure.
Okay.
And then there are a lot of pop-ups too that aren't even selling any products, as it sounds like you've seen. It's just there for the marketing. And these are getting, they're starting to look more and more alike. I'd say they're all so Instagram focused. All these, you know, neon pink and bold patterned things. Right, where you just pose. So that's kind of brands trying to catch up too. But I think, yeah, the stores are going to look different. They're more experiential. This is a trend that's been going on for a while.
I want to spend my money on experiences.
Exactly, because we're millennials. So yeah, I mean, we might even see more, you know, startups opening restaurants or opening beauty salons, things like that.
We're excited / terrified of the future.
I'm just secretly wondering, is Amazon going to be the only retailer in 20 years? But
Oof, yeah. I think everyone's wondering that. It's tough. I mean, I think, right, department stores, Macy's, Sears, they've been suffering for a while. And I think now even other e-commerce websites that sell other brands' products are getting more and more squeezed out by Amazon. So we're seeing this is getting a little bit niche into retail, but private labels, a lot of strengthening in private labels because if you're a retailer, you want to have your own brand so people have a reason to go to you instead of Amazon. Mm. So we're seeing stores move into the brand space and then brands move into the store space with some of these brands opening their stores for the first time because the brands also want to be less reliant on Macy's and Sears and all these stores that are struggling. You know, they don't want to tie their futures to that, so they want to take control. So we might see less separation between the retailer and the brand in the future.
Absolutely. So Zoe, we're also curious, like you're pretty much slaying. Your career is amazing. Our listeners know you're an amazing speaker. Like your insights are awesome. We can include links in the show notes for all of your accomplishments. But what are your life goals outside of your career as well as your long-term career goals? Like, do you see yourself growing in the analyst space? Or, like, doing your own thing? Like, what's next? Even distantly, like, your boss shouldn't listen to this and, like, worry you're going to quit because you're obviously amazing at your job.
Thanks for clarifying. It's interesting to think about. I do love this job a whole lot. So I really like the combination of writing and looking at these emerging technology trends. You know, I mean, it's always been a dream to write a book. I could absolutely see that. I feel like even, you know, writing a memoir about some of those crazy communist banquets and stuff I saw in China would be interesting. So I really want to continue writing for my whole life. And also just be someone people trust to come to for these thoughts and these insights. That's very exciting. I recently launched my own newsletter. So that's, you know, I'm looking forward to building that up in the near term. And then, you know, outside of work, I think I love writing. I absolutely want to continue that. I think, living in New York's a whole lot of fun. I love taking advantage of the restaurant scene and the gallery scene and all that. So I think there's a lot to look forward to.
Oh, we would totally read your book.
Yeah, we would buy it.
Aw. All right, I'll mark you down. 20-year pre-order.
Yes. You got to get the pre-order so that it becomes number one on Amazon in the first week because if your book isn't the bestseller on Amazon in its category, no one's going to buy it.
Smart at that point when Amazon is like moon Amazon or whatever, like it'll, you know.
Send your product from the satellite.
I also really want a job just thinking about all the ways that you can make a warehouse close by and patenting all of them. That sounds really fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Being like a futurist, I think, is a super cool job.
Also, this is total aside, but futurists, I feel like most of the people that our society acknowledges as futurists are dudes and men. So anyone who's wanting to be a female futurist, please come on our podcast, Zoe included, of course. But if you consider yourself a budding futurist, like, I'm over it with respect to male futurists. Like, if Elon Musk talks about dudes going to the moon, like, one more time, and then, you know, Musk lovers are going to be, like, commenting on our podcast. Just kidding. We don't have enough listeners to have haters. But yeah, female futurists. I'm here for it.
I love that.
So I think you're definitely a budding futurist. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, and of course, you know, trying to stick up for women. I mean, I think it's exciting to grow yourself, you know, for you and for me and for everyone as a woman. Just you do a lot by growing in your own personal role and setting that example, but then also, of course, supporting other women and helping sort of open up the world of tech and of futurism.
All right, Kayla, it's time for shameless plug time.
Shameless plug time.
All right. Whatever. Zoe has already mentioned her newsletter. I am a subscriber, 100% recommend. We can put a link in the show notes. Also, hard plug for her Twitter. I can't believe you went Twitter viral after only being on Twitter for like a hot second, but that's how good her Twitter is. You should do it. Also, follow her on LinkedIn and become her 58,003rd follower. What else, Zoe? I feel like I've plugged enough of your things, but tell us more about your newsletter and whatever else you want to plug.
That's pretty fantastic. No, I mean, I'd also love to hear from other budding female futurists. That sounds fantastic. I'm excited about the newsletter. You know, you can check out the CB Insights blog, just cbinsights.com/research. If you look up CB Insights CBT newsletter, that'll be my newsletter. Sign up there as well. Feel free to, reach out. I love hearing from people. This is all terrific.
Oh, Zoe, this has been fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. This was fantastic.
Thank you so much. This was really, really great.
Oh, thank you.
And listeners, if you love this episode, please don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Podomatic. You can follow us on Twitter @DoubleShelixPod. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon.